Thank you very much. It is an enormous pleasure to be here at KITP. UC Santa Barbara is a truly wonderful place with a lot of great physics going on. As for the city of Santa Barbara, it turns out that the region has a much richer history than LA itself. I have recently come across this map from the 17th century. Despite the fact that California was thought to be an island, a careful eye will notice that the name Santa Barbara was used for this area already at that time. Anyone looking for Los Angeles on this map is doomed to fail. There's absolutely no sign of LA. Okay, here is a brief outline of my talk. So before diving into the details, I will show the general method one uses when compactifying one dimension on a circle. This idea was introduced by Nima Arkani Ahmed and collaborators. Next, I will talk about the work which we did on the vacuum structure of the standard model with two spatial dimensions compactified on a torus or a sphere, as well as the case of all spatial dimensions compactified on a three torus. Then I will describe how finite temperature effects influence those vacua. And finally, I will end by showing how to calculate transition rates between vacua of different dimensionality. Most of the work I am presenting here is contained in three papers written in collaboration with my advisor, Mark Wise, a postdoc, Koji Ishiwata, and a grad student, John Arnold. So let us enter this mysterious world of compactified dimensions. One of the most fundamental questions in cosmology and high energy physics is why our universe has three large spatial dimensions. This may be tied to a more general question about the overall shape and structure of the universe. Are the three dimensions we live in flat and infinite as they appear, or does the universe have a non-trivial topology? Well, the long-distance effective theory of our world, the standard model coupled to gravity, has a unique four-dimensional vacuum. Nevertheless, as was shown by Nima Arkani Ahmed and collaborators, it also has a three-dimensional vacuum if one dimension is compactified on a circle. So let's look closer at the procedure they used. Imagine that each point of the 2 plus 1 dimensional spacetime has a circle attached, compact third spatial dimension. Where does this lead to? I will quickly go through Nima's derivation, as their case is much more intuitive than the ones that we consider. So one usually starts with the Einstein-Hilbert action in four dimensions, which describes the standard model coupled to gravity at zero temperature. This is the Ricci scalar, Planck mass, and the determinant of the 4D metric. This potential here contains contributions from the cosmological constant, as well as other possible contributions, which I will discuss in a moment. If one dimension is compactified in a circle, the space-time interval takes this form, where r is the radius of the circle, and phi goes from 0 to 2 pi. Now, using this metric to rewrite the action and integrating over phi, we arrive at this dimensionally reduced action. Now, the important thing is that the radius of the circle has been promoted to a dynamical field called the radian. Now, this action is given in the Jordan frame, so the Ricci scalar is multiplied by the radian. So this potential V doesn't have the usual physical interpretation. So stable points of the action not necessarily correspond to minima of this potential here. So what one usually does is performs a conformal transformation to the Einstein frame. And indeed, this is the form of this transformation in this case, where r, small r, is just some scale. And in the Einstein frame, the action takes this form. And this effective potential here does have the usual interpretation. So minima correspond to stable stationary points of the action. Now, this V effect is obtained from the potential in the Jordan frame, essentially by dividing it by the radian square. So as I mentioned, V has contributions from the cosmological constant, as well as Casimir energies of the standard model particles.
Yeah, sorry, what were the lower and big R there? I got that.
Oh, this is just small. It's just a scale to set the units. And this is R, is the radius of the circle.
OK, so the thing which is variable is big R.
Yes.
Okay.
So So, of course, Casimir effect is well known in quantum field theory. The simplest standard example is of two uncharged metallic plates placed in a vacuum. Since they provide non-trivial boundary conditions for the photon fields, virtual photon fields, an attractive force between the two plates is generated. This was confirmed experimentally many times. Our situation is a bit different, but the boundary conditions which we impose on the fields in the compact dimension are also the source of Casimir energy. So going back to the calculation Nima did, the effective potential consists of two parts, the cosmological constant, which contains both the observable value and the quantum correction in flat spacetime. And here we have a sum of Casimir energies, where rho 4 is the 4D Casimir energy of a scalar field, and NF is the number of degrees of freedom, with an additional minus sign for fermions. So it is equal to 2 for the photon, minus 4 for a Dirac neutrino. Now this rho 4 is calculated as the expectation value of the 0,0 component of the stress energy tensor, and it can be shown to be to look like this. The sum over the modes comes from a periodicity requirement on the field, and this formula assumes periodic boundary conditions. Now, obviously, this formula is divergent and requires regularization. I will say more details about this in the case we considered. Let me just mention that the divergent piece coming from this expression is exactly equal to the sum of Casimir energies of particles in flat spacetime and is exactly canceled by the quantum correction to the cosmological constant, the bare value of the cosmological constant. So the final result has no divergences and consists of the observable value of lambda, which is an extremely small number, 3 times 10 to the minus 47 dV to the fourth, and the Casimir energies are given in terms of modified Bessel functions of the second kind. And it is the presence of this small cosmological constant and lack of other classical contributions which make quantum corrections important. An important observation is that Casimir energies are exponentially suppressed for r much greater than 1 over the mass of the particle. So if we are interested in low energy effective theory, it is only the photon, graviton, and neutrino Casimir energies which are relevant in our analysis. So this whole analysis depends only on the IR physics, and nothing depends on the UV details of the theory. So it can be shown from this formula that the massless boson contribution to the effective potential goes like minus 1 over r to the sixth, whereas NF is what? NF is number of degrees of freedom for a given field. I'm sorry, this must be a typo.
It kind of makes a difference.
So those are...
Looks like it should be...
No. The sign is... So Casimir energies, Bessel functions are, of course, this is positive. So this minus sign is correct, since Casimir energies for the bosons are negative. So it should be a minus sign. I'm terribly sorry for this mistake. This should be a minus sign here. So that's why for massless bosons, they go like minus 1 over r to the sixth, whereas for fermions at small r, they go like plus 1 over r to the sixth. And of course, the cosmological constant contribution behaves like 1 over r squared.
Now, fermion, there's an issue whether you use periodic or interperiodic.
Yes, so we use periodic boundary conditions for the fermion.
What's the reason?
Because only for periodic conditions the vacua exist. For antiperiodic, the Casimir energies. So for fermions, the Casimir energies will go like this. For periodic boundary conditions, for antiperiodic, they would be negative. So there wouldn't be a region which could produce a minimum of the effective.
Yeah, I thought you said that we just got negative.
Well, for
massless bosons, you said negative.
For massless bosons, the contribution is negative. So for massless bosons, it goes like this.
There is no vacuum.
So there's a subtle interplay between the fermions and the bosons. So the fermions have anti-periodic boundary conditions. Both Casimir energies are negative, and no minimum is formed. So maybe the next slide will...
I'm confused about something else. If you go back one slide, the original integral, the vacuum energy, but you're working in three dimensions, that's what confused me. I guess it's cubically divergent. I see. But in four dimensions, it would be quadrically divergent. You need two subtractions. Here, you only did one subtraction. But he's doing it in three dimensions. Okay. Three-dimensional space-time, right?
Okay. This is... Yeah. Three-dimensional space-time with one dimension, the fourth compactified on a circle.
Right,
so it's four dimensions effectively.
Mm-hmm.
So the R's from this...
I think some of the confusion is that formula you wrote there, there's no minus one with the spin or anything. I mean, there's no difference between fermions and...
So the only difference between fermions and bosons is in this factor of degrees of freedom, which includes a minus sign for fermions implicit. I should have added this at the beginning. So NF has minus sign for fermions included in the definition.
And the sign should be minus.
And this sign should be minus. So this sign is correct. So the fermionic contribution is positive, and the bosonic contribution is always negative.
Is it possible to get the bosons anti-periodic in this sense?
Well, you could try, but for anti-periodic conditions, for the fermions, they would... Depends on which spin connection you choose.
Yeah, so for the fermions, they have, since there's always the two choices of spin connections, for the bosons, there could conceivably be a symmetry that allows you to... If it's symmetric undertaking the field to the minus the field. I guess that depends on the details of the model, in this case, the standard model, whether you can use that symmetry or not.
Yeah, so we considered only periodic boundary conditions.
So you didn't
We didn't look at the other. So the effective potential from Nima's paper looks like this, as a function of the radian. So for large r, it just goes like 1 over r squared. For small r, since there are more degrees of freedom from the neutrinos than from the graviton and photon together, it is the fermionic Casimir energies which dominate.
So this is for the standard model?
This is for the standard model with one dimensions compact.
Oh, masses for neutrinos?
Masses for neutrinos, I will show how we... So they are extracted from the mass splittings, and the potential is plotted as a function of the lightest neutrino mass. So the neutrino masses are crucial because it's only because they are on the order mass of the neutrino to the fourth is on the order of the cosmological constant from the splittings, this vacuum can exist.
Is this chart for the which kind of mass are you giving the neutrinos?
Well, it can be the Dirac or Majorana, so the number of degrees of freedom. So this is just an overview. I'll go into the details in the next case. So the only possibility for the bosonic Casimir energies to influence this picture is in this small region here, when the Casimir energies are exponentially suppressed for the fermions, and the cosmological constant doesn't dominate yet. And indeed, if neutrinos are Majorana, there is always such vacuum forming, a minimum of effective potential, which corresponds to a new three-dimensional standard model vacuum, and it's anti-de Sitter. Whereas if neutrinos are Dirac, it can be either anti-de Sitter, Minkowski, or de Sitter. And an amazing thing is that it appears for R on the order of microns. So this circle is stable when it's on the size of approximately 20 microns. Another intriguing thing is that the cosmological constant was larger by a factor of 10 or more, those vacua wouldn't exist at all. So we finally reached the topic of our first paper. Instead of compactifying one dimension on a circle, we looked at two dimensions compactified on a two torus. We chose the two torus since it has the most natural topology with zero curvature. So the procedure is similar as in the previous case. We write down the space-time interval, where here Tij is the metric on the two torus. It consists of a volume modulus and two shape moduli, tau 1 and tau 2. Again, rewriting the Einstein-Hilbert action, the four-dimensional one, we can integrate out, integrate over y1 and y2, and arrive at this dimensionally reduced action here. Now, the main difference is that this time the conformal transformation to the Einstein frame does not exist. What we can do, however, is introduce a small but positive epsilon, keep it finite, and try to dimensionally reduce the action for 4 plus epsilon to 2 plus epsilon dimensions. And indeed, if we consider this case, a conformal transformation to the Einstein frame does exist. It is of this form here. And the effective potential looks like this.
Could you explain physically why Einstein frame doesn't exist in this case?
So if you write down the powers of the rate, the A,
yeah.
It is not...
is this a mathematical statement? Or?
Yeah, it's because this is in two dimensions and it has an A square in front. So it turns out if you write down the general possible conformal transformation for G and transform the Ricci scalar, it's not possible to have this factor in front, not dependent on A.
So then I was wondering why NEMA would stop at the compact by one dimension. Is that the reason?
No, he actually gave similar arguments. He just couldn't regularize the Casimir energies.
Uh-huh.
That's what we did in the first paper. So of course something bad to this transformation happens at epsilon equals zero, because this transformation is ill-defined, and the effective potential is effectively zero. However, since we have to look for stability conditions keeping epsilon finite, it turns out we can derive non-trivial conditions for the stationary point. And in the shape moduli sector, they are, of course, the standard ones, since there are no taus in this conformal factor. But the other stability conditions turn out to be the potential in the Jordan frame being zero at the vacuum. And the stability condition requires the first derivative of V with respect to the volume modulus being negative. Now, from the equations of motion, one can see that stable vacua, which correspond to dAv being negative, are necessarily anti-de Sitter, since the Ricci scalar is negative. So now going back to the calculation, the potential can be written as before. And now the Casimir energies contain a double sum over the modes, since we have two compactified dimensions. Now, obviously, this expression is divergent, and we regularize it using dimensional regularization. So we set the number of dimensions to n, and first perform this integral over the momentum. So I wrote down the resulting expression just to show that in the limit of n going to 4, it contains a gamma function at its pole. So it's manifestly divergent. But that's not all. This double sum over the modes is divergent as well and requires regularization. And this is the essence of our paper, regularizing this expression and showing that the divergent piece of this term is exactly equal to sum of Casimir energies in flat spacetime, which is canceled by the quantum correction to lambda. So just to give you a small taste of the regularization procedure, those are the expressions we had to work with, called the extended Chola-Zelberg zeta functions, using identities of the involving Jacobi theta functions and properties of the modified Bessel functions of the second kind. They can be expressed in terms of Epstein-Hurwitz zeta function, which in turn can be regularized using similar steps. So I'm not telling you the details, but this was essentially the hardest thing to do. And here is the final regularized formula for the potential. So as before, it has a piece with the observable value of the cosmological constant, and the Casimir energies expressed in terms of modified Bessel functions of the second kind again. So they are exponentially suppressed, those terms, for A much greater than 1 over the mass of the particle. And again, only the photon, graviton, and neutrino Casimir energies are relevant to our analysis. So now we have a non-trivial subspace for shape moduli. So one would have to numerically find minima of this potential with respect to tau 1 and tau 2. There is, however, a quicker way. Namely, the potential has a symmetry. It's invariant under SL2Z modular transformations. It is not possible to see it easily from the previous form, but if we go a step back and look at the not regularized sum over the modes, it is easy to notice that the generators of SL2Z transformations correspond to simple redefinition of indices and leave the whole sum unchanged. So now we made use of the theorem that fixed points of SL2Z modular transformations correspond to stationary points of the potential. There are two fixed points for those transformations, and we checked numerically that only the second one, corresponding to tau 1 equal to a half, and tau 2 equal to square root of 3 over 2, corresponds to extremum of the potential in this subspace. And the first point is a saddle point. So full of hope, we adopted those values in subsequent analysis, hoping that this will correspond to a minimum, not a maximum, of the effective potential. So the last thing we have to decide on, as there was a question, whether neutrinos are Dirac or Majorana, so the number of degrees of freedom, and on the mass hierarchy. So everything, all we know about neutrino masses for now is the solar and atmospheric neutrino mass splittings, with the atmospheric one being much larger than the solar. But we don't know the sign of the atmospheric neutrino mass splitting. And this sign determines the hierarchy. So we can generate all the masses given mass of one of the neutrinos, let's say the lightest one, so number one in case of normal hierarchy, and number three in case of inverted hierarchy. So now we are ready to plot the final result, namely the potential V as a function of the volume modulus A. So those, the red curve corresponds to the lightest neutrino massless. The orange curve corresponds to 10 millielectronovolts. The green curve, 20 millielectronovolts. And the blue curve, 30 millielectronovolts. I'm really tempted to say MeV, but I'm afraid I will be off by 9 orders of magnitude. So we are looking for points which both the potential is 0 and the first derivative is negative. So those points are suspicious. And the final thing we have to look is whether the potential has a minimum of the shape moduli sector. And indeed, we confirmed that those points are, correspond to minima in the tau 1, tau 2 subspace. So those points correspond to new two-dimensional stable vacua of the standard model, which are necessarily anti de Sitter through the equations of motion. Now, those vacua do not appear for all neutrino masses in the case of normal hierarchy Dirac neutrinos. The lightest neutrino has to be heavier than 4.4 millielectronovolts for a vacuum to appear. And a similar situation is for inverted hierarchy Dirac neutrinos, but the mass allowed mass range is larger. They have to be heavier than 1.1 millielectronovolts. Now, the surprising thing is, again, the size of this torus is on the order of microns, again, which is similar to the previous case of a circle. For Majorana neutrino, situation looks even better. Here, for any lightest neutrino mass, there exists a stable two-dimensional vacuum.
What about axions?
Well, the axions would most likely make those vacuum more stable, since they are scalars, as they are bosons. There's also, yeah, the issue of the flux, and this could mess things up, as Nima suggested in the paper, but not making use of this shift symmetry, just saying that they are bosons would make the vacua deeper. Of course, if there are more light degrees of freedom, which we haven't discovered yet, this could change this picture dramatically. But this is just corresponds to the standard model vacuum without any addition. So this is really exciting. We showed that neutrino the masses of the neutrinos determine the existence of new two-dimensional standard model vacua with two dimensions compactified on a torus of a given.
What about a chemical potential? the real world, there's a neutrino inside the finite temperature. How about neutrino?
The finite temperature. So I will get to the finite temperature in a couple of slides. So increasing temperature washes out those vacua. That's the final thing.
So you can put in numbers for 3 degrees of like neutrinos?
Well, we can show at what which temperatures they are. Which temperatures they will be washed out. So those vacua exist always when neutrinos are Majorana. And for Dirac neutrinos, they exist in a large range of lightest neutrino parameter space. So the other thing we looked at is when two dimensions are compactified on a sphere. But this case is different since there is additional contribution to the effective potential coming from the curvature of the sphere. So if you write down the space-time interval and dimensionally reduce the action, the potential will contain an additional curvature term, which is negative and has Planck mass squared in the numerator. So it overwhelms the Casimir energies for all r much greater than 1 over the Planck mass, so the Planck length, which is well included in the low energy theory we are interested in. So we check there are no stable vacua in this case. One can obtain stable vacua introducing a large enough magnetic flux, but Casimir energies don't play any role in their stabilization. So I will briefly go through the other case we considered, namely when three dimensions are compactified on a three torus. This case seemed really interesting at first, since it has been argued that compact flat universes are much easier to create than infinite flat or closed universes by Andrei Linde, Serbian Skinzeldovich. So full of excitement, we looked at Nima's paper, where he introduced a few initial steps. So the metric for the torus is much more complicated in this time. It consists of the volume modules and five shape parameters. After dimensionally reducing it to one-dimensional action, we see that we denoted the shape moduli as a vector psi, just to have a compact notation. But the thing I want to point out is that the volume modulus has a negative definite kinetic energy, and this will be the source of the problem, and one of the sources of the problem in this case. So looking at the equations of motion in this case, the first equation of motions implies that the potential has to be zero, vanish at the vacuum. And the second equation of motion implies that the derivative of the potential with respect to the volume modulus has to be zero at the same point. So this already signalizes a huge fine-tuning. So the case loses its importance. Nevertheless, we proceeded. The other equations of motion yield standard stability conditions in the shape moduli sector, whereas the stability condition in the volume modulus sector requires a second derivative of V with respect to the volume modulus to be negative. So without showing any details, this is the formula we obtained for the regularized potential after using similar tricks as before. Here, d prime, delta 1, 1 are extremely complicated functions of the shape moduli, which I would need at least 5 or 6 slides to write them out explicitly, which I didn't do. So now one would have to find minima of this potential with respect to 5 shape parameters. Well, of course, numerically, I don't know if that's possible or not to do it in a real time. But there is a symmetry. Without going to the details, I will just say that there is just one specific choice of parameters, the shape moduli, for which correspond to a stable to an extremum of the potential. So this point can be either a minimum or a maximum of the effective potential. All the other points are only settled points.
Is this the SU3 lattice?
This SL3Z.
No. The shape of the torus presumably is something that has a triangular symmetry or it's a halo symmetry or something like that. How do you mean SU4 lattice, right?
Well, this is a So the theorem, I think it goes one way. So fixed points of a...
No, I know that, but just, you know, thinking of force theory.
So essentially, we analyze all points on the boundary of the fundamental region, which, and also on special points with special symmetry.
I understand that, since if I have one maximum,
it's not a compact modulus.
It's not a compact?
Not compact.
Okay, I will finish the contours.
Well, so at the end, this case doesn't give any non-trivial results, which I will show in a second. So this is the only point which we found that is an extremum, considering only those the fixed points of this transformation. I guess that there might be some other ones. But the potential looks this way. Here's a plot for four different lightest neutrino masses of 0, 1 millielectronvolt, 5, and 10 millielectronvolts. And remembering the conditions for a stable, for a stationary point, V has to be 0, and the derivative has to be 0 at the same point. So only the orange curve has a shot at corresponding to a vacuum. And indeed, full of excitement, we check this point. It corresponds to a minimum in the shape moduli sector. Unfortunately, then comes the final condition of the stability, and the second derivative has the wrong sign. So this point corresponds to a non-stable vacuum, and only for one particular lightest neutrino mass. Similarly, for inverted hierarchy Dirac neutrinos, for Majorana neutrinos, there are no vacua at all. So summarizing, this case is not that interesting, although it required much more work than the previous ones. However, although it's not appealing, it might be interesting for a slightly different reason, which I will mention just as an aside. I have recently calculated the particle production rate in a three torus universe. And in this case, the Friedmann equation looks the same as for a normal Friedmann-Robertson-Walker case, but instead of A being the scale factor, which can be rescaled by an arbitrary number, now it has a physical meaning. It describes the size of the three torus universe. So here is a plot showing the size of the logarithmic plot, showing the size of the universe as a function of time in inverse GV units. So assuming the current size of the universe of 10 Hubble radii, and knowing how the universe evolved in the past during the matter domination era, radiation domination, and inflation, we can evolve A back in time and obtain its value at any particular instance in the past. And surprisingly, when I use the values of the inflationary parameters from the literature, approximately 7 to e folds of inflation, and the beginning of inflation at 10 to the minus 35 seconds, I realize that the sum of Casimir energies, might have been comparable with the total energy density of the universe at the beginning of inflation, if the difference between the fermionic and bosonic degrees of freedom is on the order of 10 at that time. Moreover, if the Casimir energies dominated the universe before inflation, it would expand like the square root of time, so just like in the radiation era. So an evolution back in time, for this case, yields the size of the universe at Planck time equal to the Planck length. And this condition is not possible to fulfill if we consider closed universes because of a huge, huge contribution from the curvature term. But let's get back to the main subject of the talk. Until now, we were considering only the zero temperature case. A natural question arises, what happens at finite temperature? How does temperature affect the vacua which we found? Let me concentrate just on the compactification on a circle case. We analyze also the other compactifications, and the results are analogous. So the action, instead of a scalar potential, contains a matter Lagrangian, and it yields the standard Einstein equations with a stress energy tensor. This reduces to the normal scalar potential in the limit of 0 temperature. So we chose the stress energy tensor of a perfect fluid with the energy densities and pressures here in the non-compact space, and PR the pressure in the compact space. So assuming a homogeneous universe, the radiant depends only on time, and we allow a non-zero curvature in the non-compact space. Writing out explicitly Einstein's equations, one can combine them in such a way that the curvature term disappears, and we obtain just a minimally coupled scalar field equation of motion for the field log r, when on the right-hand side we have the pressures and the energy density. So let me denote the right-hand side by W3. Of course, for a stable point, for a stationary point, W3 has to be zero. So if we show that it's always positive or always negative, this will mean that there are no stationary points. So to check this, we have to calculate the energy densities and energy density and both pressures. Well, nothing easier. We just use the thermodynamical equations and calculate them from the free energy, which also can be calculated and consists of the zero temperature piece, which we had before, the Casimir energies and the cosmological constant, and a finite temperature contribution here, which vanishes in the limit of temperature going to zero. Well, those two terms are divergent, contain divergences, but we showed last time that those divergences cancel, and we obtain a finite formula for the free energy. This enables us to calculate the energy density and pressures and plug them in to the formula for W3. So here is the plot for inverted hierarchy, normal hierarchy Dirac neutrinos of the right-hand side of this equation of motion for a few lightest neutrino masses and the temperatures zero, upper left, 30 Kelvin, 40 Kelvin, and 100 Kelvin. So increasing temperature pushes the curves up, and at some point they don't cross the zero axis at all. So the interpretation is that temperature washes out any vacuum structure which might have resulted in the at zero temperature. This also explains why the universe that the evolution of the universe, if there at the time there was temperature, was unaffected by the Casimir energies of the particles. This result can be understood analytically by looking more carefully at the equation of motion and writing the right-hand side at the high temperature limit. So the temperature contribution goes like T to the fourth. And now everything becomes obvious. Increasing temperature washes out the subtle interplay between the cosmological constant and Casimir energies, which existed at zero temperature. This explains also why the universe didn't settle in one of those vacua at its early stages, early evolution. Well, those vacua simply didn't exist. So in the paper, we couldn't calculate this factor sigma 3. So I set myself a little goal for this talk to calculate this factor explicitly. I will very briefly show the main points of the calculation, since they are pretty entertaining, since we are talking about compactifications. So in the paper, the energy density can be calculated as a proper derivative of the free energy. And the non-zero temperature piece goes like temperature to the fourth, and we are only able to obtain this factor numerically. So the path I took to calculate this factor analytically was use the amazing equivalence between finite temperature field theory and the Euclidean quantum field theory with time compactified on a circle of radius 1 over 2 pi times the temperature. So concentrating just on the massless scalar case, we're working in this funny spacetime. I have a circle cross R2 cross a circle, where this is time and this is the compact third dimension. The energy density can be calculated by taking appropriate derivatives of the Green's function in this spacetime. And this Green's function, after a rather lengthy calculation, can be expressed as a double sum over the Green's functions, the propagators in momentum space of a massless scalar field. So putting this all together, we obtain a formula for the energy density of this form. In the limit of temperature going to zero, only the first term is relevant, and we recover the zero temperature Casimir energies. Whereas in the high temperature limit we are interested in, the first and third term are negligible, and the second term gives us exactly the value we had before, which is equal to pi squared over 30. But I guess it's too late to put this in the paper at this point. So the final thing I wanted to discuss today is the possibility of transitions between vacua of different dimensionality. Since most of those vacua are anti-de Sitter, it is impossible to tunnel from those vacua to our four-dimensional vacuum. However, it seems exciting to investigate the possibility of a future tunneling of our universe to one of those vacua. So let me concentrate just on the two-dimensional case. So such a transition, for such a transition to be possible, the standard assumption is that the topology cannot change. So our universe, the two dimensions of our universe, have to have the topology of a two torus. There are, however, papers claiming that topology changing transitions do occur. However, we'll stay conservative and use only the knowledge that is well understood and assume our universe has a topology of R cross a two torus. Of course, the universe already cooled down, so the shape of the effective potential is well approximated by its shape at zero temperature. And we know how it looks like in the two-dimensional case. Looks like this, the potential in the Jordan frame. And we are able to identify this point as an anti-de Sitter stable vacuum, and this point as an unstable de Sitter vacuum. So just analyzing the equations of motion, we can visualize, although the effective potential in this case doesn't exist, we can visualize the motion of the universe as it were described by such an effective potential here, where this minimum here corresponds to the anti-de Sitter stable vacuum, and this bump corresponds to the de Sitter unstable vacuum. So what we are interested in tunneling from here, where our universe is huge, from the false vacuum to this true vacuum where two dimensions are compactified on a micron size two torus. So the standard prescription for calculating the rates is simple. We write down the equations of motion in Euclidean space, which are obtained from the usual equations of motion just by switching the sign of the potential. Next, we find finite solutions connecting both sides of the potential barrier, which correspond to points lying on opposite sides of the Euclidean minimum. After finding such a finite solution, we plug it into the action and calculate the so-called either Hockey-Moss or Coleman-DeLucia-like action, which enables us to estimate the rate to be e to the de Sitter action minus the instanton action. So already at this point, we have a de Sitter action since we are starting from the de Sitter space. So we have to subtract the background. This de Sitter action is an enormously large negative number, -10 to the 122. So we already at this point know that those transitions will be extremely suppressed. However, the question is whether the transition is possible itself and how much enhancement comes from the instanton action. So following this prescription, we wrote down for the two-dimensional case the Euclideanized equations of motion. B is the volume modulus, and A is the scale factor in the non-compact space. Here, C just depends on initial conditions. So assuming different initial conditions for B and B dot, we were able to find a whole class of finite solutions connecting both sides of the potential barrier. Here is one of them. This is how the volume modulus depends on the Euclidean time. It grows and then stops. And here, and of course, goes back. And the scale factor in the non-compact space grows, goes to a maximum, and goes down to zero. So this describes a perfectly finite solution. So we chose this particular solution, plugged this into the action, and estimated the Coleman-DeLucia-like instanton action to be -10 to the power 61. A similar number is obtained for other solutions connecting the two sides of the potential barrier, and also the Hawking-Moss-like instanton. solution, which corresponds to the universe sitting at the top of the de Sitter space.
So, why is, well, I don't understand the sign. This is essentially calculating the tunneling probability?
Yes.
It's coming out to be bigger, much bigger than one?
No, no, so this is, so the de Sitter action is negative, and this is also negative, so there's... So this is just subtracting the background, so you would have...
What background? I mean, the instant is describing the tunneling.
But this is a gravitational instanton, yeah. So since we are tunneling from the de Sitter space, we have to have this de Sitter action in the formula. Otherwise, well, in the flat space limit, well, the instanton action becomes infinite, so this would... So the enhancement is large, but not large enough to make this order one. So the of course this rate is extremely suppressed, e to the minus 10 to the 122 times this factor. But the punchline is that this number is non-zero. So assuming that our universe has the right topology and the existence of the lower dimensional vacuum, so the proper neutrino masses, well, it looks like the universe will eventually tunnel to this lower dimensional vacuum in the future.
Wait, what happens to all the matter that we have in the universe?
Well, it depends.
I mean, one can do double UKV approximations for tunneling in the presence of a state that is not the vacuum.
Tunneling from the Sitter space? What are you tunneling from?
Empty the Sitter space.
In the Sitter space, but with the topology of a R cross two torus. Yes.
Infinite.
Well, one dimension is infinite, and the two torus.
Infinite. That's a stable vacuum.
Well, it's very. Yeah, it'll be the limit of R going to infinity, the shape parameter going to infinity.
But is in our actual
final state
of our universe, since it's all exponentially growing, won't you expect the size of the large dimensions to get bigger and bigger as time passes?
So of course,
yeah. Basically, like this transition should get harder and harder as time
passes. No, so the effective potential, it looks like this. Of course, if we're rolling down the potential here, then of course the size of this two torus, those dimensions are getting larger and larger. This is, we are far away here, the universe is really large. But if we tunnel to this vacuum, the two dimensions will be stable and the micron size.
You're saying that the probability of this tunneling doesn't depend on how far out we are?
It probably depends on how fast that machine can draw, how fast that thing.
Well, it depends, yeah.
Obviously, if it fell off, so. Sharp rates and flat rates with zero arcs, you could tunnel easily. So you have to know the asymptotic formula of the curve of RJ.
So
but it may be that having escaped the tunneling some time ago, we're now relatively safe. It probably decreases with expansion.
Two obvious possibilities. The curve goes from a finite value and then drops to zero for infinite, after an infinite range, in which case the zero tunneling. Or it drops immediately and it goes to zero infinity, which
goes to the final. But only you have zero momentum in the final stage. You have momentum in the right. So you're rolling down the hill, so you have no velocity on the start.
Is the universe rolling down this hill, or is it a point at infinity?
Yeah, we were just rolling down this hill, so only at some point of this hill.
Okay, so as time moves on, we're actually moving outwards on this.
Yeah, we're moving here because we know the universe expands, so the torus has to become larger and larger. So we're tunneling from some point. So I think the intuitive interpretation is a thermal excitation of this de Sitter space when it jumps to some point here, and then because of the existence of interpolating solutions, it will pass through the bump and then relax to this vacuum.
So to get to the T2, I guess you've made a T2 identification of the flat slices of VS4, is that right? But the usual Euclidean instanton for DS4 is round. You can't do that. Okay, how do you, is that consistent? But think about the instanton. If, when you say the action of DS4, I think so now what you mean.
So this was just an estimate we did. So we essentially assume the topology of the universe, and you're saying it's incompatible with the sitterness?
Well, the usual, I'm not sure, I'm just curious what the calculation was, because on the one hand, you need the Euclidean theory identified by key two, by the two torus, actually. But what one usually means by the Euclidean DS4 instanton is force here. Where does your 10 to the 122 come from? What's that? What is the geometry that gives you that 10 to the 122?
This number here?
Yeah.
This we just assumed without any connection to topology, just the
force here.
Just the four.
So I think this is related to this question. I mean, that it's not clear that calculation has anything to do with this process, because this process would have to involve something that had the two torus there all the time. Mm-hmm. You're calculating from a space that has a big two torus to a space with a small one. And everybody's confused by how you can do this. And your instanton doesn't really describe this process because it's a forcer.
So, yeah, that I completely agree with your comment. We just assumed that, assuming that this topology, we could estimate the current action, the sitter action of this form.
So, where did the 10, the 10 to the 61st, what's the instanton what does that instanton look like?
So it's just a symmetric solution, right? So it's just e tau squared, a squared, phi squared. This is in the lower dimensional
sphere. So I mean, is it basically just that variable? I mean, is it anything we can do, which is just the WKB factor for that potential you've put on there? I don't know if that's...
No, you're rolling on the hill. So
but you're rolling on the hill, so...
So I wouldn't use the WKB if you're rolling on the hill to just tunnel, because sometimes to trust the tunneling calculation, you have to be sitting still.
Right,
otherwise,
right.
You have to modify the tunneling amplitude of WKB to take into account that you have some untriggered energy that you're rolling down the potential.
Yeah.
So, I have to be honest. This is just an estimate, assuming that we can use this formula from the force here for the sitter action and use this formula. And the only thing we did is found interpolating solution between two points connecting the barrier, but how it gets to this point through a thermal fluctuation, this we didn't consider.
Is it an accident that 10 to the 61 is the square root of 10 to the 122?
No, absolutely not. absolutely an accident. Yes. So, ending this journey in the land of the compactified standard model, let me briefly summarize. It turns out that for most scenarios of neutrino masses, there do exist new vacua of the standard model when either one dimension is compactified on a circle or two dimensions are compactified on a torus. The size of those compact dimensions is on the order of microns, and most of those vacua are anti-de Sitter. And what is interesting, Casimir energies play a crucial role in the existence of those vacua. If we consider three dimensions compactified on a torus, there are no new stable vacua. We showed that finite temperature effects wash out any vacuum structure existing at zero temperature. However, if our universe has the right topology, and this our reasoning can be is really correct, and we can interpret correctly the tunneling rate we calculated. It turns out that our universe might tunnel to this lower dimensional vacuum in the far, far future when it's only full of Hawking radiation from evaporated black holes and extremely sparse. But this has to be provided that the topology of our universe is correct, or topology changing transitions are possible, or this argument works. We estimated the rate, and it's extremely small, so no worries. We are pretty safe, at least for some time. Thank you very much.
Any more questions for Bart?
Okay, let's thank Bart again.